Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. This week on the Dev Team, Ryan takes the word of the day, hackathon. Jake runs us through the news on Docker Desktop, Maui delays, and the Age of Empires 4 stress test. Lastly, I want to talk about what we do when we fail.
All right, so we are recording a little later in the week this week, and so it just happens to fall on one of the CodeWorks student hackathons. So I figured, what better than to talk a little bit about hackathons and what they mean to you guys, what they mean to those of us in industry, and you know, the types of ones we've been to and experienced, and maybe start a discussion around that. So, you know, again, from my perspective, I've always found hackathons quite enjoyable. I remember the kind of early days of hackathons where it's a whole weekend thing. It was like a LAN party, but you know, kind of doing work. But it was still fun. You know, it's something we use as a learning experience. You know, we're challenging ourselves, learning new things, trying new technologies. And I see a lot of that kind of trend from vendors and such. You know, there'll be like, here's an AWS new product hackathon because we want you to just mess around with it for 12 hours. Right. And then you've got your more competitive style ones. You get, you know, you build a team on the fly, and you've got yourself a designer, you've got yourself a project manager, you get yourself a couple of developers, and you actually, you know, come up with something random out of the blue. And then obviously you guys are using hackathons as more of a training aid, more of a kind of a, you know, a place for folks to come and do some extra work, you know, try some extra things. So talk about how you guys use hackathons in your kind of education process.
Yeah, we've been doing hackathons for quite a while. And I think one of the things that we try and stress is they should be fun. So, of course, if anyone hears hooting and hollering and shouting in the background, hopefully that explains that away a little bit. But hackathons, I think, are a great opportunity for us, especially in our cohort, we do two actually throughout the cohort. The first one is more of that, like, hey, this is the first time you're going to work on a full stack project as a team. Here's a short little window into it. We're kind of capping off what is effectively our node week. And they've already been doing a bunch of stuff in the client. So it gives them an opportunity to build and break things and try and fix them in a little bit of a less of a low risk environment. Obviously, we're a school. We have what we call checkpoints, of course, which are, you know, kind of those points where we say, hey, you know, this person can do this or that. But the hackathon isn't a graded thing. It's something that we just do as a fun learning experience. And it lets students kind of take that first shot of build something and kind of do what you want a little bit. Kind of take those reins off.
Yeah, and I think I have to point this out because I remember, and like Mark said, we've been doing hackathons for a real long time. And I remember when a student asked me around like 9 o'clock at night, and they said, "So when do we actually start hacking?" And I was like, "Well, hang on a second. Let's clarify, right? Like hackathons, we're not hacking people, right? In the traditional sense of, you know, we're doing anything cybersecurity wise. It's, you know, yeah, we're taking a stab at learning something new. We're doing it in a fun environment. And you know, that we definitely use that here at CodeWorks as a learning opportunity, as Mark was talking about, for sure, where it's very low stress, right? On the flip side, Mark and I, we've participated in the high stress competition. You've got 48 hours to complete something and there's money at stake, right? And we've won a couple of those, you know.
Yeah, where's that big giant check? We actually did get
yeah,
it.
We got a big check. One of those big giant, like, you know, take a picture behind it. It was great, right? those types of things are really fun. And the very first time we participated in one of those, it was, you know, learning VR development inside of Unity with the C# language, right? And Mark at the time was even just a student.
I was still a student, and it was one of those things like, and we hadn't even touched at the point I was at in the curriculum, we hadn't even touched C#. So there's a whole language there that had to be learned. And then on top of that, like Unity is what we ended up using for that. And then VR on top of that. And so it was a lot. But I think it's one of those things that even people coming into those more competitive ones who don't have a lot of experience, as long as they keep an open mind and they try and push themselves, you can learn a lot. And I think that there's been a lot of things that have come out of hackathons further and farther. That particular project, we actually, the very first time we did, it was the second time we did one of those VR hackathons. We actually ended up releasing that project on Steam and sold like maybe like 200 copies or something, like $5. So it wasn't like a big deal, but it felt really cool, right? I have amongst my accreditations that I'm a published game developer.
Yeah, well, and you know, talking about hackathons and tools that come out of them, Twitter Bootstrap, right? If anyone still remembers the days where Bootstrap was Twitter Bootstrap, I'm talking the CSS framework. That was a project that was started by two developers at Twitter on a weekend hackathon. And I mean, we look at Bootstrap now and it's a CSS framework that pretty much everyone in the industry uses, right? And of course, there's arguments for those that don't want to do Bootstrap, but you know, it is definitely an industry standard. So hackathons, you know, again, they're supposed to be fun, but a lot of times, you know, these projects that you're building can turn out to be really cool things for sure.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, you know, again, I remember those early hackathons that I participated in. Again, you know, they were all night or all weekend, you know, you kind of not eating, no sleep, but if you do, it's under the table in a big room with a bunch of other people still working, right? It was just, you know, it's a kind of a weird vibe. Obviously, when we do those kind of internally from a kind of, you know, enterprise kind of perspective, obviously we try and take things like, you know, inclusivity kind of serious. So, you know, we don't have hackathons on the weekend because our staff go home on the weekend. And they spend time with their families. And whilst it sounds fun for some of us who may be younger or single to go, oh, yeah, let's do a weekend hackathon, you can't really go to a team of 150 people and say, hey, who wants to participate in this cool hackathon? It's the weekend. You're not getting paid and there's no money in it, right? And so you're not going to necessarily get the same buy-in because it's a different crowd, right? So our hackathons are more, you know, we use them for similar things, learning and kind of experimentation. And we give people maybe a, you know, like I said, maybe a new Amazon feature has come out or a new Azure feature. It's like, all right, here's a hackathon. It's half a day. You don't have to go to any other meetings. You can all just team up. And I want you to take this new SDK, this new capability, and go build something with it. Go build something that kind of relates to our system, our product, and see how you might use this. Go and experiment. And, you know, that gets folks kind of thinking. It gets them kind of thinking, A, in context to what you're doing. So there's some potential business value at the end of it for us as an organization. They get to play with something new and exciting for them of interest, and they get to go and experiment. And, you know, that's one of the ways we use hackathons. We also use them as kind of almost like a demonstration cross-training capability. So imagine we've got customers who use our product, right? If we put together a hackathon and we invite a bunch of customers for a half day kind of, you know, go play around, you know, we've got people in the room who are, you know, competent in the system and they're kind of helping guide you. It's almost like a guided kind of lab at that point. But again, you know, people can experiment. They can kind of do what they want. It's a safe environment. They're not going to go and tear down their production system. You know, we build management systems for, you know, enterprise software. So playing around with our systems in the wild means you're playing around with enterprise systems behind the scenes. So giving them a safe place to experiment and kind of, you know, explore is useful because they go back to their part of the org and they're like, hey, you know, there's this new tool. It's really cool. We can use this to make our systems better because I got to spend a day playing around with it in a safe space and not actually worrying if the next command is going to bring down production, right? So, you know, we use them in things like that as well. And also getting across kind of like new concepts, new capabilities. You know, when containerization was kind of new, we put together workshops like that. Like, hey, you guys traditionally write full fat web stacks. You use IaaS, you use VMs. What if we taught you about containers, how you can write, you know, what is the, let's take your code, let's wrap it up in something new. And, you know, we're going to talk about containers in a bit, Jake. You know, what does this look like? What is, you know, go and experiment, go play around. This is not, you know, you have this window of time to mess with, right? It's not something, because, you know, your day job gets in the way a lot. You know, whilst a lot of us are passionate, we like to talk about, hey, I'm going to go play with Maui, you know, sounds really cool. If it's not part of your day job and it's not actually going to drive any business value for you out of that, unless someone gives you permission and a window to do it, you're very unlikely to find the time to do that unless you're, you know, again, young and single and maybe your weekends are spent doing those things. But again, we don't generally take that assumption in an enterprise environment. We don't want to. We want to give people the place and time to do that, you know, while they're on the clock, so to speak.
I think that's absolutely important. You know, and I think that's part of what makes a good hackathon is having those constraints kind of set, right? Like, we're specifically going to be focused on this. There are a couple of people who, you know, do know the system. You know, they may not be experts at it by any sense of imagination, but they do know it. They've had their own hackathon on it already, type of thing. But having those clear constraints and that time to just focus with no other distractions, I think, is what makes hackathons fun, right? And I agree with you. Like, I remember when we first started doing hackathons, they were 24-hour events, and it was just crazy, right? And nowadays, you know, fast forward 6 years, hackathons end at midnight, right?
Yeah, I feel old. I just get about 2 o'clock and I go, nothing's good coming out of here.
I mean, I heard the last one I missed went way past midnight. Come on.
I mean, if I'm being honest, the ones that go past midnight, it's usually YouTube videos after midnight. So.
Yeah. And if my wife's listening to this, it's definitely productive work that I need to be here for.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, my bad.
But that said, no, I think it is important to distinguish that corporate, like, hey, we're just going to do extra work for 24 hours, because then it's just, oh, here's just more overtime work. And so it definitely loses.
And I don't get paid for it. And yeah, they're kind of forcing me to, because if I'm not there, like,
right,
I'm not a good team player. Like, that's a bad situation to put your employees in, of course. That's not how you want to do it.
Yeah, there's definitely cultural kind of points in time in an organization's growth where that might work. You know, startups, you know, they've got a different vibe than an established enterprise, right? I mean, the people that have joined a startup are already taking risks. They know they're going in with the hopes that this will be something down the road. And spending their weekend helping it to be something more is kind of part and parcel of the course. It's kind of what you get into when you go into startup life, right? But those folks who work in more established enterprises, they didn't get into it for that. You know, they but that doesn't mean they're any less passionate about certain things. So you want to make sure you can give them that opportunity to still, you know, I think it keeps people interested. I think IT can become a very drawn out after a time. If you never get a chance to, let's say you were a .NET developer and you worked in a big enterprise, a good chance you're still writing in .NET Framework 4 because, well, that's how it works. And so, you know, how do you, you know, I was playing around with .NET Core 6 the other day. I was playing around with this. They've got the kind of minimal API concept. And I'm sitting there looking at this file with 16 lines in, and it's a working API with Swagger UI in it and a bunch of other things turned on. And I'm like, 16 lines in a single file. That's not very C#. Right. I was sitting there going, where's all the other files just hidden? Do they exist behind the scenes? How does this work? And, you know, to a .NET Framework developer, that you'd be like, huh? Like, that's usually 40 files and, you know, about a 10 meg package just to get that working, right? You know, and that, to me, that's because I get given the opportunity to explore like that. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of folks in positions in kind of enterprises where if you give them that opportunity, they'll jump at it. I mean, that they want to be excited about work. And sometimes you take that away from them and they kind of, you know, they don't necessarily want to be there anymore. So I think hackathons and kind of that kind of, you know, permitted experimentation, I think is very important for just, you know, general well-being.
I think one of the last things I'll kind of add here is for anybody who's like a junior, or maybe isn't a part of a company yet, or, you know, is early in their phases and wants to kind of continue to grow. Maybe they're learning to code or something, but there's a website, I think it's called Mintbean.io or something like that. And they do run a lot of public hackathons that are like, hey, build a website that involves music, or build a website that, you know, XYZ, that's definitely more approachable for junior developers. So for people looking to have a specific motivation and work with a group of people and be able to show off some of their work, at least as company touts that, yeah, they, you know, they do have other, you know, employers check out, oh, who won this? Or it's something to put on your portfolio or something to put kind of on your resume that, oh, you know, I won or I participated in the, you know, fall, whatever, Mintbean hackathon. And it's a good opportunity. I'd encourage people to look at it. I don't think it costs anything. They're not like a sponsor or anything either. So, no guarantees, but, that said, maybe something to look at, or even, you know, if you have friends and stuff like that and you say, hey, you know, let's build Mario Kart. Wouldn't that be fun? Let's try and build Mario Kart in 36 hours and see what we can get. Or maybe it's not even a game. Maybe it's, you know, oh, I want to build a grandparent tracker, or, you know, I don't, maybe you could check in on your grandparents or something. And it's, you keep track of their memoirs. Oh, that sounds like a fun app, right? Let's build it. But we don't have a lot of time because, you know, we have our other lives and jobs and stuff like that. So get together and definitely do it. I encourage people who have the availability to absolutely take advantage of it.
And I think, Jake, you know, one last thing. I think if you had a bunch of people asking about hacking during hackathon before, I think now that your cyber class is coming to bear, I think you're going to get a whole lot more of that.
Hackathons may be changing for the cyber class, truthfully. So let's actually roll forward. Let's start talking about kind of the news of the week, some of the big ticket things that have kind of dropped. And I would imagine, Ryan, you've seen this, but Docker Desktop, Docker released, you know, hey, we're no longer free for Docker Desktop. And I think the internet, at least in the dev circles, like exploded with just pure ire when it was first announced, and people didn't bother to read the extra like sentence that said, for companies that are raising $10 million or have more than 250 employees.
Are you telling me that people only read the headlines and form an opinion on that?
I mean, I'll be honest, as a company with more than 250 people, we have absolutely had a lot of scrambled meetings this week going, oh, what do we do? What does this look like? I mean, you know, we've been encouraging developers to use Docker fairly substantially recently. There's a lot of benefits to kind of encapsulating a lot of what we do, especially in our build and release process, you know, into containers. And here's the thing, like Docker, the CLI tool, that's not changing. None of the licenses around that are, it's really Docker Desktop, but there's something to be said for how easy Docker is on Windows when you use something like Docker Desktop. If you happen to be using Linux or a Mac, probably not super required that you use the desktop version, you know.
Yeah, but I thought all you ops guys are just CLI junkies anyways.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean all my developers are ops guys, right? There's definitely, and it's not just my part of the org, like that these emails have started coming across from all different parts of the org going, whoa, what does this look like? Do we have an enterprise agreement? Do we have a relationship? Has anyone in, and when you're an org this size, generally, the answer is yes, 50 people have already bought it, you know, from 50 different parts of the parcel, right? And it's like, so what do we do? Can we consolidate that? Can we make sure we have one agreement? You know, does it have agreements in orgs like ours have to go through legal? You know, then there's a lot of process involved. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting kind of, you know, we're literally looking into it right now. What does this mean for us? Are there alternates out there that we can use? I mean, there are other open source tools that, you know, that replace, you know, the need for the Docker engine, and you still do containers without Docker. And so, yeah, it's been an interesting week. I won't lie.
I would imagine, you know, but then, and that's a good example of, you know, that enterprise level company, right? And Docker it's an amazing tool. The Docker Desktop is crazy helpful. So I can understand where, like, hey, if you want continued support and development around this thing and you're an enterprise, you pay for it, right? And that seems reasonable. And then those smaller companies can still benefit from, you know, nowhere near 250 employees, we're nowhere near $10 million in revenue. I use this to deploy, and we use Docker, right, with inside our GitHub Actions and things of that nature, to deploy to Heroku a container for our students, right, as an example, a demo, things of that nature. And so we largely are using the command line anyways. So it's one of those things, though. I find it interesting when people instantly get angry, but then don't have all the information, right? But it is fascinating to kind of hear, like, yeah, this is definitely going to be affecting, you know, larger companies like yours, right?
Well, it's interesting that it's almost like the complete opposite approach to how Microsoft approached dev tools, right? So Microsoft, a lot of the dev tools and platform tools have always been free, maybe not open, but they've often always been free or affordable, because if you can buy into the platform, you start buying everything else, right? And obviously Docker, you know, you talk about GitHub Actions, right? There's no real changes to pricing. Like, if you're using Docker it's just firing up again, that hasn't changed. That the problem is the tool that enables all of that for everybody, like for you guys, it's Docker Desktop, right? You don't sit there wiring up actions by hand and just hoping the container works, right? For them to remove that authoring capability, like, what does that look like for the rest of the ecosystem? And you know, obviously Docker has been going through its own challenges. It tried the whole Docker enterprise thing, you know, how can we make money from Docker? And then obviously you've got even like Kubernetes changing the actual runtime from Docker to something else, right? I mean, I understand that there's some challenges there. And I think, you know, if they're regearing as a dev tool company, like we create a tool that helps developers. I mean, absolutely, it should probably cost some money, because it definitely does improve the productivity of developers. But I think it feels rushed, and it feels like the things you get with the expensive versions don't necessarily match to the things you might need or want, right? And I think that's, you know, again, that's all open to change too, I imagine. We'll see how much, you know, companies are pretty good these days about taking kickback very, you know, abruptly and adjusting and pivoting as they need to. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, hopefully those companies are agile. But, you know, and I would agree that, you know, Docker seemed to kind of just like pull the trigger on something. Like, they announced it and it was literally like, this goes into effect tomorrow, right? And now, granted, there's a 1 year grace period, but it's like,
oh, no, I thought it was only till January 2022.
Yeah. You know, and so there's a little bit of grace built in, but it's not much. You know, and so just, you know, something to pay attention to for sure. I do have to kind of call it, you said Microsoft was cheap. I think I remember the developer license.
Let's not say. Here's the thing: Microsoft have always been a platform company, right? So what they do, and they've always enabled that one way or the other, whether that's free or discounted stuff for students, because you get them in hooked while they're young, or whether it's you guys yourself took part in, I think it was the DreamSpark program, DreamSpark was the student one, and then BizSpark. And so they've always had ways of kind of encouraging people to buy into their systems, and then once they're bought in and they're hooked, they're like, all right, they're on the line, we can expand. And I'll be honest, that sounds negative at some point, but at the same time, if I was a startup and somebody gave me a bunch of tools to solve a problem, and you think what cloud does for us today, it kind of gives us that anyway. I only have to put $10 down and I can experiment, right? Back in the day, you couldn't. Back in the day, buying Visual Studio would have cost you $3,000, right? Buying Windows would have cost you a couple $100. And so to do that commercially as a startup is very kind of, just going to use Linux, right? Obviously, that's what helped Microsoft keep people in their ecosystem. That is, like I said, it's not cheap once you get into it. But I think it is very powerful, and it is one of the ways they've kind of done good by their developers, is to kind of give them a lot of that capability and tooling and encouragement to kind of use the rest of their ecosystem, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we definitely I jumped ship from AWS when I had the BizSpark. I tested out, I tried it. Absolutely loved Azure and kind of the cloud system there, and we talked plenty about Azure like 2 weeks ago, I think that was
with Scott.
But I don't think it's bad to get people hooked, and then hey, if you want to pay for additional features, you're gonna pay for additional features, that's fine.
Well, and from kind of the stuff I've seen and worked with, a lot of the Microsoft tools are good.
They're amazing.
I'll give them credit. They're good tools. And, the other thing that's great about them is, they're constantly improving them. They're constantly adjusting, coming out with, new and improved stuff. I'm super excited for MAUI to come out this year.
Right. That's my next ticket item. Okay. Mark's trying to move this conversation along.
I was giving you the opening, but I think, you see Microsoft take on things and this sounds like,
Excel is still the most used database in the world.
I would believe that.
MS Paint. I'm going to come back to MS Paint. It's an amazing tool. But that said, there's something to be said for companies that build good tools, and I think that's worth acknowledging.
I would absolutely say, Microsoft, especially in the last couple of years, they've pushed a lot of things to open source. Like, you want to go contribute to VS Code, go contribute, right? Like, use the GitHub platform. Like, I love the direction that Microsoft is currently going, and I would agree. Like, I've used Microsoft tooling from a development standpoint for years because it is so nice, right? And of course, you have, companies like JetBrains that have developed amazing plugins for like Visual Studio and whatnot. So like, I'll happily pay that extra little fee for JetBrains plugin, ReSharper. It's absolutely awesome. Still waiting for the VS Code version of that, by the way. So to talk about, I guess, that next big thing is, sometimes there's delays, right? And that's Microsoft with MAUI. I know I talked about that. I think it was like episode one of this season. Super excited about MAUI. It's been delayed. Right. It's being pushed back. Release is not going to be November like it originally was going to be. I don't know if they've actually released when they think it will be ready. Now, of course, it's still out there for testability. It's just not general use yet. So they're still kind of working out some bugs. They're still, recommending that for now, don't push things into production under, the MAUI platform. It's not quite ready.
And I think this is one of the good things they've got out of decoupling a lot of these things. So I think the goal was for MAUI to come out GA as .NET 6 came out GA, right? And they do go hand in hand. They've been developed together alongside each other, but they're not tightly coupled in that manner. And we see this in the PowerShell space quite a lot, right? So PowerShell Desktop, PowerShell 5.1 is tightly coupled to Windows, which means its release cadence is tied to Windows. PowerShell Core decoupled from that. So PowerShell Core, which is now, it came out as version 6, it's now version 7 point something, it iterates on its own cadence. Now, the downside is it doesn't come packaged with Windows, right? Which means it's not universally available in every Windows box. Doesn't mean you can't install it, but it means when you show up in an enterprise with 30,000 servers, there's a good chance they're still running on 5, right? Because 5 is there. And that's the thing. Obviously, if you go and grab .NET 6 now, .NET 6 doesn't have MAUI in it. MAUI is its own little thing. But I think .NET and .NET Core have been doing a really good job of that decoupling anyway, right? And that gives them the ability to, sorry, this part is not ready, but this other part is, so we're not going to hold you back from this part. We're just going to keep this part back until it's ready. And you say ready, even when it comes out GA, you know, you're probably still going to run into bugs, right? More ready.
More ready. I was going to say, isn't that the whole concept behind provisioning and, DevOps, right, is let's use the tools that are available at the versions that are available, and let's provision all these different systems. And, you know, let's use an orchestration to make sure that this entire fleet of systems that are going to boot up are running the environment that is predictable, right? Like, I mean, that's part and parcel of what we're trying to accomplish with DevOps entirely, right? And so I think just being able to pay attention to those different, you know, release cycles is important. I do like the direction that Microsoft has said with that, right? Yeah, let's decouple. Let's, you know, when the tool's ready, you can have it. Until then, yeah, you know what to expect. And you know, as long as we adhere to kind of the versioning changes, if you're not releasing breaking changes in a subversion, then I'm perfectly happy with that.
Well, and so .NET 6 itself also, as part of, you know, alongside, I won't say alongside this announcement, I think also this week or last week, I think .NET 6 went to RC1. Now, RC1 is what they, I think this
locked
what they
in feature set, yeah,
locked in code complete, right? So outside of bug fixes, like if you start using this now, there's not going to be any weird breaking changes, new things added, new things removed. It's like we're going to fix Sev bugs and that's kind of it. Like it's ready to go. Obviously, the support thing around it is not there. It's not GA. But I think, you know, if I'm a developer and I'm developing something, like I know it's coming out and I know what .NET 6 lifecycle is going to be. So, you know, am I too scared to, you know, I'm not going to shy away from it right now, especially if I'm starting a new project.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we've had a hackathon around that, right? So let's talk about the one other very important piece of information this weekend for all of our users, which I guess listeners, they won't hear this until after this weekend, unfortunately. But so Age of Empires 4. Is stress testing this weekend. And so stress testing, it's, you know, let's everyone jump on. Let's try to get as many users onto the system at once. Let's see if we have any, you know, drops in communication. You know, a multiplayer is a part of this, of course, right? And so we're stress testing. Can the servers actually adhere to the server load that's going to be coming down the line? So that's, I think, super cool. And I appreciate it, especially when you think about when Diablo 3 released and no one could play for the first, like, what was it, 2 weeks?
I don't think
you couldn't play Diablo 3 because servers were down constantly.
I don't think they made any other Diablos than 1 and 2.
It is a shame.
It's okay because they're making 2 again. This is the new thing right now. We just now release old stuff, but we update the graphics.
Is Age of Empires 4 for mobile?
I got this text from my buddies back home in England. They're like, hey, multiplayer stress test, Age of Empires 4, go install. And they've released it. I think it's available in the Microsoft Store, like the Xbox app thing. It's available on Steam. I mean, they're really obviously, you know.
I mean, it is multi-platform, so maybe it's on the
please
phone.
Please go and install it everywhere. But yeah, I think we're looking forward to helping, obviously, do our part to stress test.
Absolutely. I'm doing my part. And it's one of those things, you know, there's so much nostalgia with Age of Empires and 4 is a different beast, but man, I remember spending hours on Age of Empires, like 1 or 2.
I think 2 is the big one. I have a guy on my team loves Age of Empires. So he has like the Age of Empires 2, like remastered. And every time I'm logged onto Steam, he's there playing Age of Empires again.
Has it the same cheat codes? That's what I want.
Big Daddy got you the race car with the
how do rockets. I turn this thing on?
The Flying Dutchman.
Yeah.
So the boats could go on the land. You got to think back to some of those nostalgic moments, right? You know, and this is a great thing is I love that, you know, multiplayer still is so much more accessible. And I know this isn't the topic of the news, but, you know, good old LAN parties and all that kind of stuff. It's great that you can play with your friends in England, right? Here in Idaho.
That's right? True. LAN parties were in my garage and everyone brought over the CRT monitors, right? You'd set them up.
Well, we had big ones. Like we would all load onto like a coach type thing. You know, we're all sitting there with these CR21 CRTs in our laps. They're like bigger than we are because we're like 50. And we're driving halfway across England to go to like a hall or, you know, a YMCA or something equivalent just to hang out for the weekend. And you know, before that, it was like null modem cable. It's like, oh, we can play two player, but we need to put this serial cable between our two computers.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
Well, you even had whole businesses that did it too. There's a place here in town I remember called Rampage. Do you remember
Rampage? Oh my God. Yeah, I totally remember Rampage. Yeah.
And they would have like these LAN parties and stuff like that. And so, again, I know this is not the topic of the news, but, you know, like there's a certain level of nostalgia just playing games with your friends. That I think, you know, online does a good job. Again, you know, connecting people where you can't, but I kind of miss sometimes those days where it is like everyone's set up. And again, this is my much older brain looking back on.
I was going to say, how old are you, Mark? Are we reflecting back you know, here?
I'll be honest.
Waxing philosophically here.
So before I left England, you know, most of the organized big LAN parties already started to die off because once everybody had broadband, it wasn't quite as a necessity. But, you know, me and my buddies, there'd still be a bunch of people show up at my house every couple of months for the weekend. You know, there'd be four computers in the living room.
I mean, you got the deep fat fryer going. Yeah. You know, you constantly are throwing in like the cheese sticks or the chicken nuggets or whatever. And
you don't mess around, man. Yeah.
Heck no, man. We had fire codes. We
got Mountain Dew and Doritos.
Mountain Dew towers, right? Yeah. Like we'd go and I remember we'd run to like Jack in the Box as well and like drive through, right? And Jack Box open 24/7. So it's, you know, roll up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Can we get 100 tacos?
Man, we don't have no 24 hour restaurants. It was much, much lamer for us. We're like, well, we got to go to the grocery store.
I think the last big LAN parties I was a part of was like Halo parties. Everyone would bring their Xbox over and we'd play Halo.
And those
are the good old days.
That's
right?
The death of the LAN party.
I mean, and I think that's kind of to throw this straight back into hackathons. Like, as an adult, right? As an adult, hackathons,
LAN party for grownups,
type of fun, right? It's LAN parties for grownups, LAN parties for work, LAN parties for fun, and a lot of those elements you can kind of, you know, recapture.
We actually, both of my good best friends in the UK are they're in IT. I remember we had this thing. We actually set up a LAN party weekend. We called it Tech LAN. And we showed up and we did networking. You know, the guy who was the Cisco guy taught the rest of us like Cisco networking. And one of us was teaching us kind of, you know, Photoshop and a bunch of, you know, Premiere Pro. They did a lot of that kind of stuff. And we're all just kind of sitting there learning new skills. You know, we did something similar when like Azure came out. We're like, oh, you know, let's log into Azure for the weekend, set up a blog, blob storage, static, you know, and we, you know, and that's the thing. That's, you know, we called it a LAN party because that's what we always did. But basically it was us doing a small group hackathon with some goals, right?
Well, I guess to cap that off, go get your Mountain Dew and Doritos and stress less test Age of Empires.
Yeah, let's absolutely do it.
I'm gonna put my Pizza Hut order in. Let's do it.
Usernames to come out, right? Yeah. Join me in Age of Empires.
Certainly don't have an appropriate username, so right. From that.
It's not just Mark.
So I think let's talk about like, and I don't, you know, time will tell, but what if this stress test fails? Right. What if Age of Empires sucks this weekend?
Then I'll never play it again.
That's a lie. That's not
true. You know, I'm trying to lead you into your topic.
No, there, I know, Mark, I know. So,
is a stress test not designed to fail?
You know, there's that. Right? but no, that's and that's maybe not quite exactly where I was going with that. But let me kind of reframe that since we're going to pass it over to me here. So, kind of what I want to talk about in the deep dive is what do you do when you fail? And that can come in many different forms when I say fail, whether it's failed to meet a deadline, maybe you're like a consulting type company and you lose a client or you're a consultant yourself and you get removed from a project or you push a big production and the whole thing crashes. And we've talked about, you know, reverting all that back. And
that
stuff.
Never happens.
But what do you do when you face essentially catastrophic failure? How do you not only just recover from it, but how do you process it? What is your, you know, when's the last time you had a major failure and what did you have to do to move forward from there?
Yeah. So
by the way, this is actually one of my favorite interview questions to make people really uncomfortable.
I think this is a good interview question, right? Cause I think it's a fallacy to think like, oh, I never fail. Like, oh, I'm perfect at everything, right? Like, no. No, absolutely not. Like you're shut up, Ryan. You're going to have failures, right? And those come in all various shapes and forms, right? Like I remember the first time I got fired, right? And that was definitely like a failure and it felt like it. And I remember having to like call my wife and be like, yeah, so I'm coming home early because I got fired today. And it was just like, I felt terrible, right? And I felt like, you know, to throw this back a couple of episodes, we were talking about imposter syndrome, right? And I was like, I'm never going to make it. Like, obviously, this company just told me that I'm total trash, right? And, you know, I think there's a big piece that was, you know, I can never recover from this, right? I will never recover from this.
okay, Tiger King.
I'm sorry. I had to throw it in there.
We're glad Jake kept going the next day.
but I mean, yeah, failures come in all different shapes and sizes. You know, just just like 2 weeks ago, I pushed a change to our student like classroom tool. And I forgot to do one thing. I didn't do my testing very well. And none of our students could log in and actually see their assignment for the day the next morning. I was like,
Now, did that make them happy or
fix that real quick? And of course it was rollback one version first. And then, you know, later that afternoon I went and fixed it. And truthfully, it was a missing S. I kid you not. It was all a missing S
all the time.
Like I couldn't believe it. Like super rookie mistake, right? And that was
connection string.
Yeah.
Not connection train.
Connection train. and you know, again, a type of failure, less traumatic, you know, less disruptive than being fired from a job for sure. But, you know, failures, they happen, right? And I think, you know, being able to pick yourself back up and, you know, throw off the imposter syndrome. And, you know, if you want help on that, we talked about that all last week or 2 weeks ago or whatever it was, and keep moving forward, right? Because those things are going to happen. And you know, ultimately, you can't just beat yourself up forever about them. Like that's me. Right. And I guess, I don't know, you have any specific times you want to address or, you know, topics like.
So, yeah. So this might be a good time to bring up. I was working on something earlier today, Jake. And I'm just kidding. but no, I think we all, failure is such a big thing that, again, it happens to everybody and you have to just be ready for it. And we think back to some of our bigger failures and things that, and maybe they're not big, but they're little and they weigh on us, right? I remember when I first started teaching full-time and I had a student drop, right? It wasn't that they failed. They actively chose, this is not for me. And I was gutted. Like, it was rough because I felt I had failed that person. They came to me to learn to code and I didn't provide that for them and they left disappointed. And I think that there's some external factors there. And that's one of the big things too, to be aware of is how much of this is on you and how much of it is outside of your circle of control, as it were, right? There will be things that happen, external forces that cause you to fail. You can do everything you can to be successful and you'll still fail. And that's tough. And we talk to students who fail our course. And one of the things we always try and tell them is, this isn't necessarily mean you're done. And I hate to steal this Rocky quote, but it's not about the amount of times you get knocked down. It's about the amount of times you get up. And that's a butchering of it, but it's basically that. And I think that that's the most important thing to look at is you will fail. Like you said, anybody who says, oh, I've never failed, that's not true. Everybody will fail. And in those times, it's hard to accept that yep, this got me, I failed. But you need to be able to learn from that failure. It's a part of being a developer. One of our senior devs who occasionally comes and talks to our students says, you know, the biggest difference I distinguish between someone who's a senior and someone who's a junior is that senior has made far more mistakes and they've had far more failures that they are now a senior because they know how to solve those failures. They've moved on from them. They didn't get stopped by them. So I think that those are some of the important things to take away is that you can't let failure be something that stops you. Or if it does, then maybe what you're doing isn't for you. And that's okay. Be okay with that.
Yeah. You know, to throw a bit of wisdom that my dad, I remember I was really disappointed. I'm going back to like fifth or sixth grade.
Oh boy.
Okay. but I remember like I was disappointed. I was angry. I was mad at myself. I lost a basketball game, right? Lost a basketball game. And I was just out of control angry. I had a real bad temper. I don't play sports for a reason. But come on now. Hand gestures in this room, I swear.
So you do have the height for basketball, I think is what Ryan said.
Yeah, that's exactly what that was. But I remember my dad pulled me aside and he said, "Look, Jake, like you're never going to be the best at anything." And I was like, "Dang, Dad, that's like rough, right?" And he said, "You know, there's always going to be someone out there who's bigger, badder, better, you know, more experienced, more time in field than you are. And that's okay. Go and talk to those people, befriend those people, you know, learn from them what you can, right? But when you don't measure up to their same standards, like you can't hold yourself to their same standard if you don't have nearly the experience, nearly the time, nearly the, you know, the practice, right? And it's funny because like most of the time it's, you know, as a kid, it's like, hey, you can do anything you want, right? And while I believe a lot of that is true, you can do anything you want, but you're not going to be the best at it, right? Someone out there is probably going to be better than you. There's a reason why we have teachers. There's a reason why, you know, you have to learn, you have to practice, you have to grow. Like here at CodeWorks, we talk about T, which is time, energy, and effort. And until you've invested enough of it, you're going to face constant failure. And I think that's something that I try to explain to our students like day one. You know, as a software developer, you are constantly working in a state that is broken, because as soon as you're actually fixed the program, as soon as you've fixed the feature, you've built it and it's not broken, you're moving on to something that is broken, right? And so get used to kind of that, you know, process of I'm going to work until I'm no longer failing, and then I'm going to move to the next thing that I'm failing at.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the Rocky quote was interesting, but I think it's not necessarily just how many times you get back up. I think there's a lot of people that can get back up from falling down. It's really what you take away from that experience, what you learn from when you fell down. If you take nothing away from it, getting up one time more than you fell over is great. You're probably still in the exact same position you were the first time you did it, right? Like that's the learning part. Like every time you fail, right, you take something away from it, hopefully. And if you do, maybe you won't fail that way again. Maybe you'll fail a different way. And that's okay. Now there's something else you know not to do, right? Or not to do in this context. You know, I think anyone who's been in the field long enough will have failed. They'll have missed a deadline. They'll have annoyed a customer. They'll have tried some project or tried to create some product that never went anywhere. Oh, damn, there's no customers for this thing. You know, oops, we didn't do our homework. You know, I think there's any number of ways we can fail, but that's not a really bearing on you as an individual. If you take nothing away from those experiences, well, okay. Mark's point, are you in the right field? Are you enjoying this? Is this for you? Because, you know, part of the ever changing landscape of technology is that you need to always be learning, right? You need to always be challenging yourself. And that means you're going to fail, and then you're going to learn, and then you're going to fail at something else. And that's okay.
I think this is a Scott quote. And if you don't remember, Scott was with us 2 weeks ago, but and what Scott says, and I like this quote from him too, is he, and it kind of relates to that, is he will look for developers who have 5 years of experience, not 5 1-years of experience, meaning that you could repeat the same year over and over and over and over again. And eventually you've perfected everything you do in that year. You don't make mistakes in that, and you're perfect within that box. Whereas instead, if you've had failures, you grew, you failed, you grew, you failed, you grew. Over that time, you have now expanded and you've grown. Instead of becoming the perfect within that 1 year box, you now have 5 years of imperfect years, but continual growth and change. And I think that that's a powerful thought, is to say, you know, if I look back on where I was personally last year, have I only perfected what I was last year, or have I actually improved and grown myself?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good thing to bring up, right? Like constantly be looking. It's the, you know, don't, when you're running a foot race, you're not racing against the other competitors. You're only racing against your last best time. Right.
And I don't think that's how the Olympics works.
I mean, that's how I do marathons. Okay. That's how most of us non-athletic people will do some athletic things, right? Like I'm competing against myself.
Most non-athletic people don't run marathons.
Running is terrible.
Fair enough.
We're going to cut off your analogy apparently right here and just.
But I do think that that is true. Like I, you know, have to compare myself against myself, and it's not fair to compare myself against the smartest kid in the class. It's not fair to compare myself against, you know, anyone other than myself.
Well, Jake's first analogy failed. He learned from that and pivoted.
Yeah, I think that was
that was much better.
Congratulations. Yeah, just a little clap there. But no, and I think let me build on that and take it away. Kind of one last thing here. And that's to say that those failures, and when you compare yourself against other people, ultimately, it's the same thing with tea, right? There's a piece missing from tea, and that's talent, right? You cannot create talent. You have it. Or you don't, or you have a certain amount of it. So it may require more tea for somebody to do one thing than another person. That doesn't mean you can't be successful. That just means some people will have an easier time at that success than you. And I think that that's an important thing to know when you're comparing yourself. And this comes to imposter syndrome. It comes to a lot of different things. But I would rather have someone on my team who's tenacious, who's, you know, works well as a part of a team, than someone just who has a natural talent and is is an island. Send them on that one thing. They don't work well with others. You put them off, you send them off, and they do their thing and whatever, right?
Hey, those are 10X developers. Those are the unicorns.
I want to say I hate what you just said, truthfully, Mark. And that's the concept of talent, right? Like, and it feels like there are people out there who are just naturally gifted, right? That they're just, they have this raw natural talent. They're just better than everyone at that thing, right? And I have a hard time saying that that's entirely true, right? And the perception of ease, I think, is what people mistake, right? It's the perception of ease for that individual to, like, you know, be able to accomplish the thing that you find difficult, right? You think to them it's easy, right? And in reality, you know, it probably wasn't the very first time, or maybe they've had different life experiences leading up to that point that made them grasp that concept easier, right? Or had them, you know, better fit for what they just stepped into. But that's me just pushing against that word talent, right? Talent is definitely a thing, right? But it's like, if I can play the piano, right? And I can play Mary Had a Little Lamb, and I'm very, very good at that. Well, it's probably because I've practiced, right? And then when you have someone who's practiced 10 extra hours, is that 10 extra hours really a difference in skill? Like,
when, what is practice if not just getting it wrong for the first 9 hours?
Exactly.
I mean, I think I disagree with what Mark said. I kind of agree with, yes, there are definitely people out there with innate talent. They're you know, in a certain scope. And that's the thing. It is very scoped usually. Right? Maybe you're great at maths, that things just work in your head. That doesn't automatically make you understand every algorithm known to man. You're good at maths, you can figure it out, right? But I think you can still acquire talent, and it might be more hard work for you. But, you know, I'm pretty talented at what I do. I didn't start that way. I didn't go into the industry great at what I do now, because I didn't do what I do now when I started. I was good at other things back then. And, you know, I have learned other things over time and pivoted and changed roles and stuff like that. I remember back in the early days of my career, you know, you used to people you'd get interviewed, and they'd be like, well, you seem to have had a lot of jobs, been to a lot of different places in a couple of years. That's a red flag to us. I'm like, oh, okay, well, why? And they're like, well, what's to say you'd be committed to us? I'm like, well, right, but you're interviewing me because you put all these words out on your job ad and I ticked them all, right? Yeah. And I'm like, well, had I stayed in that one job for 4 years, I wouldn't tick all these boxes, because they had one set of tools, one set of systems, one set of experiences. So by me changing jobs, I got exposed to, you know, tool A and tool B in the same space. So I've got 2 years of experience in the space and a year in each tool. So that's useful, because you've for some reason put both of them on this job address. So you use all the tools. And that was very apparent when I moved from, you know, end user roles to consulting roles, because consulting roles, the more you know, the more useful you are to a multitude of customers, right? If I was just going to one company, did they have 6 different backup softwares? Probably not, right? But as a consultant, knowing 6 of them was useful. you can put me out there and say, hey, Ryan can figure that out. And I think, you know, that can be acquired, right? And you know, that comes from practice, and some people who don't have the innate talent have to practice more. But I definitely think people can learn and become better and potentially outperform some folks with innate talent.
I think it struck a nerve, apparently, because maybe you didn't hear the rest of what I had said there, because I agree 100%, right? It's there. And what I mean is, let me give you the person struggling, looking at the person who's not like just blowing through this, a little bit of forgiveness and leeway that I think it is true. And I will still, maybe this is the part you disagree with. I think it's true that two people can get the same thing done. For some people, it will be more tea required. And maybe that changes over time. Like you said, you know, that person A who's taking longer over time can catch up to person B and potentially exceed them. Right? But I think it's important to give yourself that it's okay if I'm not, as Jake was saying, the best person in the world at this, because reaching some of those standards and by God, maybe you are, you know, you might become the best person in the world at task, whatever. But the reality of it is that's not going to last. Time will change that. Somebody eventually will become better than you at that. And so I think that you have to accept that that's okay.
Well, and I think, you know, going back to that, and I think we've all seen this, the folks that have innate talent and stuff, they tend to have failings in other areas. And
absolutely.
I think, you think about this, as somebody who had to work hard for that, when you fail at something, you don't just learn from what you failed at. You learn other things. There are other things that build up, like you maybe learn some humility. You maybe learn that asking other types of questions is useful. If you have an innate ability, if you don't fail at that thing, you don't learn all of those other lessons. And I think, you know, that's probably why we see a lot of folks with innate talent who have other constraints, whereas folks who have kind of put in the hard graft and the years and hours of time, they tend to be much more well-rounded and much more balanced and much, you know, useful in more situations.
When that talented person does fail, they often fail harder because, like you said, they're not used to it. All right. Well, I think we'll go ahead and end there and wrap up this episode of the Dev Team. So again, we'd love to see your comments. We'd love to see your feedback. Anybody wants to post anything, feel free to submit those issue questions. We might have an AMA post in the future. But until then, thanks for joining us this week for the Dev Team. That's a wrap for the Dev Team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want clean code,
wash your hands.